So, let's start the lecture for today. So, as some people may have noticed, I'm not Professor Honegger. So, unfortunately, he had to be in Aachen today, and we got a short notice yesterday that we had to jump in for him. But anyway, so I will do the lecture today. My name is Martin Berger, and the main focus of the lecture will be on truncation. So last time I think you did fan beam reconstruction and also talked a little bit about the implications of fan beam and what's different to parallel. And very briefly at the end about Parker weighting. And this time we talk about truncation. So the title slide is actually a bit misleading because what's happening is that truncation can be in fan beam and in parallel beam. So the things we discuss today are valid for parallel beam and fan beam as well. So and the title slide suggests that it's only valid for fan beam, but it's actually for both. Okay, so let's start. So maybe I go a short. Better? Good. So maybe I guess shortly about, or maybe we have a short look on the topics of today. I will start with a short recap of what's actually parallel and fan beam. So this will be very, very easy to understand. Then I will define what is truncation. And then we talk about what can we do against truncation and what can we do against the artifacts and how can we correct for that. And at the end, we will also have a look at phantoms. So unfortunately, I got forwarded only slides for a 45 minutes lecture. So I had to come up with some new plans. So we will see how it works out with the timing and everything. And I have an additional talk prepared that is actually a final talk from a bachelor's thesis in our lab. And that's also related to truncation. Okay, so let's start with the short recap. So here you can see a parallel beam geometry. Let me just get my old school laser pointer. So clearly we have multiple sources along a line here, and also multiple detector cells here on this side. And then we basically compute the line integrals through the object from a certain angle. And that's then our projection on this side. Okay, and then we rotate either the object or the scanning system. And we do the same thing again. So you might wonder if that was ever implemented in a real system, because typically X-ray source can't produce like a parallel beam ray. But yes, it was, and they did that with a little trick. And the trick was to use this translate and rotate principle. So the very first CT in the beginning, like I think 71, and that's on the next slide actually, the very first CT used a translate and rotate principle. And what they did is they just had a detector with one detector cell. So you don't even get an image or a line, you just get one value for one exposure. And what you then do is you move the detector cell and also your source, you translate it along the line. So basically you do it step by step. So you sample this one, the next one, the next one. So this is the translation part. Then you rotate the system and then you sample again with the translations. So you can imagine that this took quite a while. So this is actually the first scanner that did it this way. And you can also see that there is not like a specific patient table here. It's just probably a conventional patient table from the interventional suit here. And in this scanner, exactly this happened. So you translate your single pixel and the source to get a projection. And then you rotate it. and then you do the same thing again. That obviously took quite some time, so an acquisition took about 5 minutes. And the reconstruction, I think, was even done iterative, so no filter back projection here. So they used this algebraic reconstruction technique. I don't know if that's been already discussed. So yeah, just wait for it and you will know how the first scanner worked. And the slice resolution was about 80 to 80 pixels. So you can imagine if you ever saw an image with 80 to 80 pixels, so that's probably not very nice. On the other hand, you can't really tell anything about a system's resolution by simply giving 80 by 80 pixels. So that just tells you that you did your reconstruction with 80 by 80 pixels. But it doesn't really tell you if the resolution of the system is good or bad, but it was pretty bad. Okay, so what happened in the years after? So people switched to fanbeam geometry. And that's simply because you can save this translation step, which took quite some time. So in fanbeam geometry, you have these point sources for the X-ray source. So you model this point source. And then you again have either a curved detector or a linear detector, as you can see here. The principle is the same. You specify your rays. And basically what you get is the integrals through the object, but this time not in this parallel fashion, but in this fanbeam fashion. And what's very interesting to know is that in this case, the Fourier slice theorem is no longer valid. And that is, of course, a drawback. So maybe one word on the Fourier slice theorem. That was already discussed. Maybe someone can actually explain that. Maybe right in the beginning, do you know Fourier slice theorem? That's Nyquist. That's the Nyquist-Shannon theorem for sampling.
So the Fourier slice theorem links the 1D Fourier transform of a projection of a object to the 2D Fourier transform of the reconstruction. So we just compute the 1D Fourier transform, yeah. And then we can fill in into the 2D image our Fourier transform, and it's the same angle as our detector would be.
Exactly. So what you do is you would simply take your projection, you would do the 1D Fourier transform, and this is equivalent to the Fourier transform of the object along this line, along the line parallel to the detector direction. So you make this link between the 1D, as you already said, you make the link between the 1D Fourier transform of a projection and the 2D Fourier transform of the object. And this link could actually also solve you the reconstruction problem, because what you want to have in the end is the object. But unfortunately, this is no longer valid in the fanbeam geometry. Okay, so here we can see actually an open diagnostic CT scanner. This is a curve detector. Maybe I just point out the individual devices here. This is the curve detector on this side. Here we have the X-ray source. And so there's basically two different CT systems. So you have these diagnostic CTs, which rotate quite fast around you, and you move the table through it, but also cone beam CT. And in cone beam CT, we will see a video on that later on. You have these flat detectors, and they are typically quite, so compared to this one, the detector size is much smaller than here, which gives you also a smaller field of view. Okay, so you have this curved detector here, as I said, and you have the source here, and then you can already see the fan. And in the early systems, the curved detector consisted of a single line. And then you just move the object further into the system to get the different slices. So you do it slice by slice. And the modern systems do it in a helical way. So you have this helix, you have a detector that has multiple rows, and then you go continuously, so you move the table continuously through the scanner. Okay, it took 20 seconds per slice, which is still quite high. And then there has been this invention with the fast rotations in 87. So they used slip rings. So I don't know if all of you are familiar with slip rings. So basically the problem here is you rotate the system, the patient stays constant. And somehow you have to get the data or also the electronic supply, the power supply and everything, to the X-ray source. But the X-ray source is rotating, right? And that's a big problem. And that has been solved with slip rings. So slip rings are in use for ages in normal like electrical motors and stuff. And what you have is pretty much you get a metal ring. And this metal ring is connected. So you have a single ring for each like power connection to the X-ray source, but also for the data connections from the detector. And the ring goes around the whole system. And on the other side, the static part, so the ring rotates as well. And the static part is just a graphite connector that touches the ring constantly. So that when you rotate, you always have this electrical connection. I don't really have a ring here, so I could show you, but I think I hope it got clear. Yeah?
Is it really graphite for medical devices? For medical devices. So when the slip ring, I can't imagine it to be graphite because...
The ring isn't. I mean, it's just the actual contact. I actually don't quite know. I know it's definitely it's probably for the power supply. But so what is the concern? What is your concern?
So with them? When you have electrical motors, when you take it out after a few years, then it will be all black and then dusty, and you have to replace the contact, and this will be very dirty, and you obviously don't want to do that on your CT.
So this could be also hidden away from the patient, of course. But I mean, I don't really know if it's pure graphite or if it's just like some mixture or even a totally different material. So the whole thing was just about to get the principle that there is like a contact and it's still there even though you rotate the system. Okay, and that allows for quite fast rotations. And now now people came down from 20 seconds to 300 milliseconds, which is obviously a huge step. Okay, so much on the fan beam and parallel beam things. Now to the question, what is truncation? So here we see a fan beam geometry. We see a homogeneous cylinder, and the cylinder is in the center of the coordinate system, x, y. Cylinder has a radius of r, and the source is denoted by a. And then our cylinder also has an attenuation coefficient rho. So if you now do a projection without any truncation, this will pretty much look like this. And I think in some previous lectures and also in the previous slides, I saw it, that you already computed that analytically. So for some simple objects, it's possible to compute the projection analytically before you even do any scan or something. Exactly. So this would pretty much be the response of the detector here. It's a centered shape, and this denotes the boundaries of your object here. Okay. So what happens if you get truncation? If you get truncation, somehow your fan angle gets smaller, and you cannot cover the whole object anymore. And what you then get is, of course, you crop your data at some point because you cannot scan the outer parts of the object. So you will lose these parts out here from this view. And suppose we move our source to here, then you will lose the parts out here. And that can be modeled by a rectangular function. So you take your actual projection that you would get without truncation and just multiply it with a rectangular function that crops the outside. And essentially the problem is now that so first of all, we get these huge steps here that shouldn't be there. I mean, it's not part of the data. And we have this missing data part here. So we don't really know what's going on in this area. So everything that truncation is simply, it deals with missing data. So you acquire less data than you would actually need for a correct reconstruction. So, okay. Let's move on. Here's again the truncation-free projection. And as I already said, you can model truncation with a rectangular function. So you just multiply this signal with a rectangular function that we have here. And now that would, of course, mean this could be, for example, a limited detector size. So your detector is only this long. And then you fill the end up with zeros because you simply don't know what's going on. Okay, so in this case, our detector would go from minus 150 to 150, but to actually visualize the whole thing, we would need a detector that goes much further, basically out here. Okay, so let's do this multiplication thing, and you will get the truncated projection as we already saw. So, does anybody have an idea where this could now make huge problems? So in the let's maybe discuss the general pipeline of a reconstruction. Maybe even parallel beam, so it's just basically three steps. So you start with, at the beginning, you do the projections, and then you have your projections. So what would be the next step in a parallel beam reconstruction? You have your stack of projections, which is your sinogram, basically. And what would you do with the sinogram in a reconstruction? These are the next two steps. So you do the ramp filtering. What properties does a ramp filter have? So which frequencies does it give more weight and which frequencies does it give lower weight? So it's essentially a high pass filter. And if we now introduce, due to our truncation, if we now introduce these huge steps here, so do you have a good feeling doing a high-pass filtering on that signal, including these steps that shouldn't actually be there? So they will probably give a huge response in the filtering step. And then the back projection is just a natural operator afterwards. But the huge problem that's coming up is actually due to the filtering step now. So let's look into that. Here we have the ramp filtering of our non-truncated projection. As we said, it's a high-pass filter, so we have at these rather fast transitions of the signal, we get very high outputs after the filtering, and rather small outputs for areas that don't vary too much, or vary in a very constant way. Okay, so let's compare that with the truncated one. So this is the outcome of a filtering step of a truncated projection. It's essentially the same object, but just a part of it. But look at the filter outcome. So this is completely different. You will now have also these peaks that go to the positive direction, and you also have these parts that drop down not so rapidly than before, when you have a look at that. And now some might already get a feeling what happens if you back project that. So back projection just means, so let's again assume a parallel case, you just smear this signal back over the 2D image. So that would mean you always smear that one back, and that one as well. And this ramp will also have an influence, what I just pointed out. And we will see that in a second. So how the actual reconstruction looks like if you have a truncation. Okay, so for comparison, I also did a filtering step of the pure rectangular function. And you can see pretty clearly that this is much more similar than this one. So here are all the three steps combined. We have no truncation on the left, so this is how it should look like. This is how it looks like with truncation, and this is the rectangle. So now what you can see straight away that there is a substantial difference between the non-truncated and the truncated one. And even worse, it's much closer to a rectangular function than to an actual projection signal. Yeah, so this difference will definitely have a huge impact in the reconstruction if we don't consider any correction for that. So let's have a look at the reconstruction here. On the left, so this is a water cylinder phantom, a numeric water cylinder phantom. And in the middle, we placed some, I think it's plexiglass beads. So these are plexiglass beads. It's actually a 3D phantom, but you just see the center slice. So what you have these five beads here. This is water, the density of water. And outside you have vacuum. So that means this is already a reconstruction. So this is not just a rendering of the phantom. And this is without truncation. You can clearly see the cylinder, the full extent, and you can see the beads and everything. And if we now, limit the detector size and make the field of view smaller, I think the limit is pretty much what I cropped out here. So it now goes until here. So we always lose the outer part of the water cylinder. Okay. So this is what's happening if you do a plane reconstruction on a truncated signal. You can still see the beads, but you can also see that there is a huge intensity drop from the periphery, from the outside of the cylinder to the inside. And if you go back, so let's say here, you can also explain why. So if you back project that from each angle, let's say we even have a full scan or 180 degrees parallel. So if you back project that ramp, this is exactly what we now see. So we have a higher impact outside and a lower one in the middle. So this is exactly what corresponds to this high intensity here, and then it drops when we go to the center. So let's have a look at a line plot that goes through the center. So this is basically the line that goes right through the center here. Ah, just by the way, I forgot that. This is cropped here. So this is just set to zero. And don't worry about that. I mean, if we cannot image the outside, we simply cannot produce any good results outside of the field of view. So I just cropped that. Normally there would be artifacts and things that would just distort the whole image. But this is essentially what we want to reconstruct. So this is the part that we can image. That is basically our field of view. And I cropped the outside to zero. So there will be things going on in the outside as well, but it's just not relevant because we don't really expect to be able to reconstruct that. Okay, so this is this line profile through the center. The blue one is the truncation free. You can clearly see the water cylinder and you can clearly see the beads, the three beads. You can still see the beads in the truncated one, but you also see this very typical effect for truncation problems. So this effect is called cupping artifact. And that is a very, very typical artifact for a truncation problem. So you have higher intensities at the periphery, at the outside of your field of view, and you have an intensity drop when you go to the inside. Overall, you also lose mass of the signal. So that means you get some scaling coefficient here. So it actually should be somewhere up here, but you lose that. So that is also a problem. What's not a problem, and that's pretty much the same what I just said with the field of view, we don't expect to be able to reconstruct this area. But we want to have a nice reconstruction of this area. So what we actually want to have in this case is a reconstruction that shows us a clear step here, and then exactly this signal, and then a step here. Okay, so now you probably already have a good overview of what truncation is and what it causes in the reconstruction. Let's just go through these again. Truncation can happen, of course, when the object extends the field of view, and we will see in a second what can actually be in a real system cases for truncation. It can be modeled with this rectangular window. That's what you also saw. So simply like a limited detector size, you can model it with a rectangular window. And because of these steps that you introduce in the projections, you also introduce artificial frequencies in the reconstruction. And basically this cupping artifact that we saw is this artificial frequency that we mean here. It causes this typical cupping artifact, which is simply this drop of intensities to the center. So what causes truncation in a real system? A small field of view, that's what I mentioned a couple of times now. And that pretty much happens when the detector is too small. So your anatomy is bigger than the detector capture range. And this happens quite regularly in like abdomen or thorax scans with flat panel CTs. Because the detector has like 30 to 40 centimeters, and obviously it can't be inside you, so it has to be somewhere behind you. And the capture range is just too small to get the full field of view. What can also happen is that you have some medical instruments either inside the patient or attached to the patient, and then they somehow go out of the field of view. Another thing that can be done is collimation. So collimation is often done to reduce dose. I don't know if you're very familiar with collimation, but maybe I just explain the principle. So in your X-ray source, what you do is you produce your X-rays. Maybe I'll just do a little drawing here. So if this is your X-ray point source and that's your beam, fan beam in this case, this is the housing of the X-ray source. And what you then have, that's called collimator, is lead plates. So you put some lead plates here, and they can be slided in. They can be moved forward and backward. So what you do is you can artificially reduce your field of view by simply moving them in, let's say here and here, and you will get basically this beam. Now one might wonder, why would we reduce our field of view intentionally? Doesn't really make sense, right? Okay, but what you do is you save the dose in these areas, and you focus on objects in these areas. So let's say here is like an organ, and here is a lesion or something, and you actually just want to see the lesion. You would focus your beam on the lesion, and you would save those outside here. So that's the intention of collimating. Okay, and of course, behind the lead no photons will arrive at the detector, so we also don't have any information there. So it's about the same problem. It's just a problem of missing information at the outside of the object. Okay, so here I have an example data set. That's actually work I'm doing in the lab. So we have these, we do these knee images from people in a standing position. So maybe I first show you the how the system, how you can actually do that. So unfortunately, the video is rotated 90 degrees, but I think you can manage that. So this is a cone beam system, the CIGO system. So you have this robot arm, and mounted on it, you have the C-arm CT system. On this side, on the top now, you see the X-ray source. This is the detector. Now it's on the other side. And the patient would now stand here in the middle. And you can basically then image the knees during a standing position or during a squatting position and investigate how your cartilage in the knee deforms or how your bones, so what they also do is they track the patella over multiple scans. People sometimes have problems with the trajectory of the patella when they bend the leg. And then they do treatment and they test for that by simply doing scans in squatting and standing positions. So this is fairly new. This works for about, like, I would say, two years now. Maybe even only 1 year. And now I will show you a data set on that, which basically contains all types of truncation that we discussed, and also other problems. So as I said, the knees are imaged in a squatting position, and the detector is too small to fit both legs. So this only is valid for a certain few angles. So if you have the detector in front of you or behind of you, and the X-ray source is here, your legs are typically too far out. The field of view won't cover both legs, including the space in the middle. But of course, if you look from this side, it's no problem at all, because here you essentially just have to image one leg. There has been a collimator used. Please don't ask why, because I really don't know. It doesn't really make too much sense in terms of dose savings here, but also it's not too much of a problem because what we're interested is this area and not up there. So you can see the collimator at the top here. So let's look at the acquisition. So there are multiple things going on in this data set. So let's first look at this truncation. Here we basically see multiple types of truncation that we just discussed. At the top, you can see the collimator boundary. So there was a collimator moved in for the scan. So as I said, please don't ask why. I don't know. It might reduce scattering, but you think because of that? To reduce the scattering effects. Okay, yeah, that might be true. Yeah, good comment. Okay, so what you see on the left here is of course truncation because we have this limited detector. Or you could also say the object wasn't properly centered here in this case. So these are the two types of truncation that we have in this view. This causes much more problems than the one on the top. So you haven't had 3D reconstruction so far. But like the very conventional way of doing a 3D reconstruction is just doing the fan beam reconstruction on every row here. And that's then called FDK, Fedkamp David Kress algorithm. But you will look into that, I think, next week. But essentially, it's just the exact same procedure, and you do it row-wise on the projection. So as I said, this won't cause much problems because the filtering direction is in this direction. So you don't really run into huge problems with the edge up here. But of course, here you will get an edge because the object is just cropped, so you don't have the field of view to cover the whole object. And that will get us problems in the reconstruction. So here we have much more problems like motion and things. So if you have a look at the beginning, so this is actually in a standing position. So if you focus on, I think the knee is a good, so the patella here, the kneecap, is a good thing to focus on, and you will see quite some shaking at the beginning. Could you see it? So it goes forth and back. And that's simply because of the standing position. So you're holding this position and it looks quite severe, but the magnification is also quite big here on the projection. So we're talking about some millimeters here. But the reconstruction suffers also, already quite a lot if you move the object in a millimeter range. Okay, so let's just explain for completeness, let's just explain the other objects as well. Here we have a bone density calibration phantom. So in C-arm CT, it's really hard to get real densities. In CT, you can actually get the Hounsfield units, and they try to do that in C-arm CT as well, but it's not really working very well. And what they here did is they have this bone density phantom. So this is this is a phantom. It's basically just a rod, and you know exactly the density of this object. Yeah.
Sorry, maybe it's a stupid question, but why don't I get to use the Hounsfield units on C on CT? Obviously, it's an X-ray tube and the detector wire went on the Hounsfield.
Yeah, you get problems with the. Are you familiar with the system? So there is an automatic exposure control.
Oh, okay.
And that ruins you quite a lot.
Okay.
Yeah. It makes absolutely sense to use it in terms of dynamic range of the detector, but it ruins you the Hounsfield units. They do that as well. So in the product, you will get Hounsfield units in the reconstruction, but I wouldn't say they're super reliable, depending also on the object that you image. Okay, so with this phantom, you definitely know. So you have a phantom that you know the attenuation coefficient, and this one is set to bone. So you can buy them basically. So I want a phantom that has an attenuation coefficient of bone, and that's why it's called bone density phantom. And you put that in, and in the reconstruction, you would then see the phantom's intensity. And you would know, okay, so this intensity corresponds to the attenuation of the bone. What you also see is these dots here. This is because of the motion. So what we do is we attach metal beads outside before the scan with some tape. And then you can nicely track them here. So you can see them quite clearly in the projections. And if you're able to track them, you can correct for the motion. So you can estimate the motion field, at least you can try, because it's really a difficult problem. And you can correct for the motion during the back projection step. So I think that's pretty much everything that's contained in the data set. Okay, so let's go to truncation correction algorithms. So the typical truncation correction is done with extrapolation. So what you do is you have this missing area at the boundaries, and you somehow want to estimate what could have been there. And there are multiple ways to actually approach the problem. But this is always the general thing that you want to do. You have the missing areas, and you want to estimate the signal that could have been there. You don't really know. That's why it's called extrapolation. But that is the task. So solution one, and I think this is done by Andreas Meyer. This was done, I think, last year. So you already discussed this defect pixel algorithm where you have exactly the same problem. So you have some missing data and you want to fill it in. So he then did this extrapolation as this deconvolution with the defect pixel algorithm. So maybe just a short recap on that. You have your ideal image, and then you have this multiplication with your defects, and you will get your image with the missing parts. So in our case, this is now done on only a 1D line because we consider only fan beam here. And the, now one might ask, where do we even know the areas from? So where do we know the defect mask from? So that is simply given by geometry. So in terms, in the collimation case, you know how much you moved in the collimator, so you can actually determine the field of view before you do the scan, which means if you have a detector here that is this size, you will know these points beforehand. And then what's typically done is you just blank out information here. So everything that's come, because it's not fully blanked out by the collimator, so everything that's coming in here you just set to zero because you don't know the data, and that's then what you try to estimate. So the defect mask is typically given by the geometry beforehand. So you should probably know where the mask is. Yeah. Yeah, that's also a huge problem. So what we did here is we said, okay, we know that at the outside you somehow want to get to zero at some point. So you assume that the object is finite, it's not an infinite object, and at some point you will get to zero. And that's basically all the extrapolation methods here make such assumptions, that at some point you have to get to zero. And that's also what we did with the mask. So the mask was basically looking like that. Now let me just see. So one is for I have a value. So the mask here for the 1D line would look like this. You have this peak at the outside because you know it's zero there. You just set it to zero. Then you have this missing part. Then you have the data that's there. Then you have the missing part again. And then again, like this peak. So that's how we set the mask. So this would be the defect mask. Zero here, one here. Unfortunately, this didn't work at all. So I don't know if it should be there as a solution method. So this did not work quite well. I mean, it's better than before. And also the reconstruction looked better. Unfortunately, I don't have a reconstruction from that. But it's not very nice. So we get this artificial frequencies going on here with this edge, which we couldn't really explain very well. So we enforced that it goes down to zero, which is the typical thing to do. Maybe we would get better results if we would use local windows, because that's what you typically do. You didn't do it in the exercise. But what you actually do with this algorithm is you take local windows and apply the interpolation on just local windows, on patches of the image. I think in the exercise, the interpolation was done on a global image. And here we also use the global one. So maybe it would get a little better if we use local windows. But my feeling is that it would be much better to go for a different solution. Simply because I think this algorithm is much better in areas where you're surrounded with known data and you have a defect in the center. Here you don't really know what's going on out here. You just assume it's a zero. Okay, and the further you go away from the actual data, I guess the less accurate it would be. Okay, so let's look into okay, yeah, so unfortunately the algorithm did not work as well as expected. This is known for a while. It's quite simple. It's called heuristic extrapolation. And if you look at the publication, it's a medical physics publication. And the idea is super simple. So if you ever have a super simple idea, go for a trundle. It's simply mirroring the values at the edge. So you have your truncation edge here. And then you act as if there would be point symmetry exactly at this edge. So you know you have your known values along the detector line here, and then you do a point symmetry exactly on this point. And you continue the line, it would probably go down here, but what you then also do is you use a cosine-like weighting function. So you have a cosine, you say the cosine is 1 here, and it will essentially go down to 0, and the argument of the cosine will have the distance to the boundary. And that will probably give you a parameter, so you can adjust that somehow. And this is exactly where the requirement comes in, that it has to be 0 at some point. So you can adjust that then with this cosine parameter. Same here. So and here you also see why it makes absolute sense to use this cosine weighting, because if you would simply extend the signal with the point symmetry here, you don't know where you would end. So probably somewhere back there, and this is not very, very realistic. So you always assume somehow that your object ends in like a foreseeable distance. Okay, so if you do that, and I think I have reconstructions on that. So this is like a kind of a Shep-Logan phantom. There is some stuff missing, I think. On the left, you again see the reconstruction with truncation artifacts. And now you also see the periphery, the boundaries. So don't worry about this part. We don't expect to reconstruct that. But the field of view is pretty much the circle here. So it's slightly over the boundary here that you can see here. So it's probably somewhere, ending somewhere here. And this is, again, the effect that we have with this cupping. We have high intensities at the outside, and then they drop to the inside. And now with the correction, this is effectively removed. It looks much better. And again, don't worry about these areas. We don't expect to reconstruct that. Okay, but we don't have this drop of intensities anymore. So it already gets much better. And the idea is very simple. You just have to know where the edges are. And for the cosine weighting, that comes more often in the other methods as well. Just one more comment on the cosine weighting. If you do the cosine weighting, you also have to know on which side you are. Because here you would put a cosine that drops down on the right side. So you have to determine, am I on the left side or on the right side, which is probably quite easy, but OK. OK, so that was the second method. The third method is water cylinder extrapolation. And the underlying principle is simply you assume that your object is a water cylinder. In most cases, it's not. But the body consists of a lot of water, so it might not be too bad to use a water cylinder. And what you then do is you actually compute the projections analytically, because you can do that for a water cylinder. So cylinder is a simple shape. And then you just use the density of water. And that's what we've done here. This is even for the cone beam case. So you assume that the object consists of water, and then you fit the cylinder model to the known data. So basically to the data in the center. This is the projection of this water cylinder and fan beam case. Here you just use the attenuation coefficient for water. And then you have the radius of the cylinder that you have to estimate. And you also have d, which is the focal distance of the system. Okay. So let's see. So what you would do is you acquire a projection data, and then for each line, so this is done line by line. For each line, you would fit this model that you see here to the known data in the projections. And if you apply that, I mean, this is a little bit cheating now because we actually used a water cylinder, so you can of course reconstruct it perfectly. So what you would do is you would take the data here in the center, use these data points, make a least square estimation for the parameters of the water cylinder, and then you have your full projection and you can simply determine what's outside. And what you then typically do is you get your estimated water cylinder, but you don't want to discard the data in the middle, right? So you somehow have to bring together the estimated signal and the actual recorded signal. And in practice, this never works as well as here. So you will get some sort of small edges around this area. And then what you typically do in water cylinder extrapolation is you have a look at the gradient of the signal around the edges. So basically, you just look for a small window here and compute the numeric gradient. And you make sure that the gradient at this point stays constant. So if you move along the real data, at some point you go from this estimated data to real data, and you adjust your estimated data such that the gradient stays constant along the line, along the profile. So that's I would say, necessary for water cylinder. I think the first idea already included that. So that's part of the extrapolation strategy. So first, fit the model to the data. Then you replace the missing parts, and then you somehow do some sandpapering over the edges here. What you can also do is, again, this cosine weighting. So to enforce, that's basically then simply a stretching of the model. So to regulate how far the signal goes out. I think these are the basic two steps. So as you saw, it works perfectly if your data is a water cylinder, but it's mostly not because patients are not water cylinders. It yields very good results for head and abdomen. So in most, so this is actually considered the state of the art. That's also used in the product. And yeah, but it will suffer a lot if you have objects that maybe are two cylinders, like the knees alongside each other. So here it probably won't work very well. There exist different versions. So as I also already explained that with the transitions that you adjust the gradient. They also did that with ellipsoids. So instead of a model for a cylinder, you use ellipsoids, which might be better suitable for the abdomen part and so on. And they also use this cosine-like roll-off to enforce that it goes to zero at some point. Okay, another thing is you can use prior knowledge. That's very often done not in the medical background, but in non-destructive testing, where you have metal parts that you want to image for, I don't know, small cracks or accuracies of some drilling or milling machines or things like that. So what you do is, because you don't care about the dose in these fields, what you do is you take a prior scan with a big field of view. And then, of course, big field of view means your detector resolution doesn't change. If you make the field of view bigger, the resolution of the reconstruction will also be smaller than if you zoom in. And so what you do is you take this prior scan, then you go to the volume of interest, which could, in a normal non-destructive testing tabletop system, this is simply done by moving the object closer to the source, which gives you higher magnification, and of course your detector stays constant, so you will definitely reduce the field of view. Okay, then you go for this volume of interest, so you move the object closer to the source. And you do the second scan. You will miss the areas again, you will have the truncation problem. But that's now no problem anymore, because then you just go for the outside with the prior scan. So the missing parts at the outside of the detector profiles are simply then filled in with the scan that you did before. So in non-destructive testing, this is no problem at all, because typically metal parts don't deform over time and don't breathe and so on. But if you want to do the same in a medical context, you first have to somehow justify that you do two scans. I mean, it's additional dose. That's why whenever you do that, you probably would go for a very poor quality in the first one, just to get a rough estimation of the outline. Or you would use a scan that has been done before anyways. But that's, however, a problem when you move the object somehow, because then you have to do some sort of registration again, and you will get alignment problems. So it's not straightforward anymore to replace the missing data. Okay, so that's pretty much all I think I said just right now. Yeah, exactly. So in a medical context, you would definitely go for a low resolution, less projections, less energy prior scan to reduce the dose, the additional dose level. Very related to this is a current research project we had. I think it's finished by now. Acquire certain full views from time to time during a scan, which is also very interesting. Then you combine this data somehow to get to estimate the local views, the outside of the local views. Okay, I actually like this idea. This looks pretty much like collimation, but if you don't use LED, but some more or less semi-transparent filter material. I don't know which material they actually would use for that. You will have some sort of residual signal in the outside of the truncated area. So that will probably look somehow like this, which means we also have our truncation, but we also get this residual signal here. And that's nice, because we can simply say, okay, so there is something coming to the detector, and it probably makes some sort of sense to use that for the extrapolation. So what you do is you detect the outline, which I think in this case, yeah, either you move it super accurate, so you know the outline, or you somehow have to detect it from the data. And then you simply magnify the areas out here such that they align with the actual data. Problem here is, this is much smaller, and this has suffered from much more absorption than this part, which means the noise level here is totally different than here. So you will have much more noise out here, because more absorption means more noise. And if you do the magnification, you will have to deal with the noise at some point. And also, to do a proper magnification, you would probably also go again for the gradient, look into the gradient, and adjust the signal such that the gradient is smooth. And I don't know if you would do a cosine roll-off in this case. Probably not, because you actually know the signal. But it can have lots of problems. Of course, it's better than no data. Okay. Good, so these are the drawbacks I just actually mentioned. Okay, that's it so far for truncation. Okay, I really managed to extend the slides significantly. I have one more thing for a truncation correction, and that's the attractor algorithm. So there's actually the I think he's doing the exercises this year. Yan Xia is one guy who's giving the exercises. He was heavily involved with the attract algorithm. And that's also a truncation correction method, but you don't directly look at the projection data to extrapolate the data, but instead you go into the math and you do something to the filtering kernel and exploit a little trick there, and that's what I want to show you now. So we already said reconstruction is first acquiring projections, of course, and then depending on whether it's fan beam or whether it's parallel beam, some additional steps. So let's say it's parallel beam, then you just straight away go to the filtering. And that's what I want to write down now. Let me just clean that. So I start straight away with the filtering step. So this is the attract algorithm. So the filtering step can be basically explained by, I will explain the variables in a second. These are our projections. S is the distance to the rotation center. Theta is the rotation angle. So this is simply so in parallel case, this would simply be the detector variable, and this would be the rotation angle. This is our filter kernel. This is a convolution operator. So we do our filtering here. And these are the filtered projections. So let's go to the Fourier domain, which is quite simple because we don't really have any functions here. So we just make uppercase letters and come up with some Greek letters, and we're in the Fourier domain. So omega xi. So from the convolution theorem, we know that this will probably end up with a multiplication instead of this convolution, and then we have uppercase P and xi. Okay, how does this look like, the actual function? Someone in the Fourier domain? Yeah, and what is it?
The absolute value function.
The absolute value function. So you would simply write the absolute value times this p. Okay. And now the trick starts from now, because we now decompose this absolute value function. So the absolute value function can be rewritten with a signum function times the actual omega. So this is negative for values of omega that are negative. And this is simply a straight line. So this is exactly the same. And now we just extend the whole thing. So we add, we multiply the whole thing with 2 pi I, where I is the complex variable. And we compensate for that here. You agree it's still the same. And now if you're familiar with Fourier theory, you will probably know that this is nothing else in the spatial domain, it's nothing else than the derivative, the first derivative along the detector direction. So a multiplication with 2 pi I and the variable that is the frequency variable is nothing else than a derivative along in the time domain. So this is the first derivative. And this is also known. This is called Hilbert transform. It's typically without the 2 pi, so this is just a scaling factor. And if you look it up in the books, it's probably with a minus, a multiplication with minus I, I think. But it's exactly the same. Okay. So this means to do the filtering, we could do first derivative of the projection, and then apply this Hilbert transform. And that's exactly the same than RAMP filtering. Okay, so let's go one step further. Why not looking at the second derivative? That would mean we extend the whole thing with 2 pi I omega. So what we would get on the right side is 4 pi squared, omega squared, and I times I, of course, gets minus. So this is nothing else than the second derivative. So what do we get here? Because we still have this part left, right? So we have the signum again. And we have also 4 pi square and I omega and a minus. So this is what they then define. So this is not very, this is not really known as a mathematical operator anymore. So in attract, in the attract papers, they always say this is called the residual kernel. So residual kernel. Okay, so how is that at all related to truncation? And that is now the trick. So assuming you do the second derivative first on the projection data, let's just draw down one of these cropped water cylinders projections. Okay, second derivative can be approximated by numerical Laplacian, which is simply a convolution. So you convolve with minus 1 to minus 1, which is simply the Laplacian kernel. And now the interesting thing comes. Second derivative is very sensitive to edges as well. So what's now happening is the outcome will probably look something like high impact at the edges and only minor impact on the actual data and zero outside. And the only, yeah. I try to do the second derivative. And if you want to do that numerically, you convolve with a Laplacian kernel. And this is the Laplacian kernel. Okay, I can also show how you get that. I do that in a second. I first show the trick. So the only trick that attract now does to the whole thing, it just says, okay, so this is very small, the data part. Why not just, and I know if I wouldn't have any truncation, this wouldn't be there. Because we don't have these edges, we don't want these edges. So why not just killing these edges and set them to zero? Or to some local neighborhood value? And then you get this updated signal, which is just containing the data part. And it's basically your second derivative of the non-truncated projection. And that's the huge trick here. You just erase the impacts of the edges. Then you go for the residual kernel. So you apply the residual kernel, but not on this, but on this. And then you will get your estimation. So this is the key trick. You decompose this ramp kernel, the absolute value function, to a local part, because this is very local. It just is a convolution with a function that has three values, so like a kernel that has three values. So it's really local. And this is global, because it has the whole omega in here. And that is cool, because what you can do is you can exploit this local part, say, OK, we don't want these edges. They shouldn't be there. We just erase them. Use the data. Go back with the residual kernel, and you did your filtering, and you acted basically as there wouldn't be any truncation. And this works quite good. OK, so that's the trick. Now to the kernel. So the easiest way to do a first derivative is to do that, right? You agree? So you just get the difference between the previous element and the next element. Now, the second derivative is simply doing the same again. And if you know how to do a derivative on a sheet of paper, we can actually do that. Typically, you just swap the two things for the actual computation. So you would go for minus 1, 1, and 1, minus 1. Then you say 1 times this is minus 1, 1. Minus 1 times the whole thing is 1, minus 1. And you add things up, and it's a minus 1, 2, minus 1. Yeah, this is a practitioner's notation. This is just doing the convolution at a blackboard. If you convolve these two things, you will exactly get this.
Yeah, I've just never seen this notation with the square brackets for.
Sorry. I mean, this is just denoting. It's basically MATLAB notation here. So, I mean, this is just the actual array that you would convolve with. Yeah. OK, good. So that was attract. Now to some phantoms. In CT, we typically use phantoms a lot because we simply cannot scan patients all the time to try something. Because of the ionizing radiation, risk of cancer, and so on. So they wouldn't feel happy, we wouldn't feel happy, and so on. So what we do is we typically have quite accurate phantoms. And phantoms can be two things. So they can either be fully numerical, so you never have a real thing. You don't even do a scan. So you just have numeric phantoms on your computer system, and you use them. Most famous one is Shep-Logan. The advantage of phantoms is we know how they look like. And that holds for numerical, definitely. And for manufactured ones, mostly as well, depends on how accurate they are manufactured. To evaluate algorithms, we need some sort of ground truth. And there come the phantoms in, because then we know how they look, how they have to look like, and what densities they have, and so on. So if we do a reconstruction, we can accurately evaluate if we know the exact shape of the phantom. So as I said, there are numerical ones and there are real phantoms. The numerical ones, we will just go through it. They are fully on a computer, so they're defined numerically, mostly by simple shapes like circles, ellipsoids, spheres, whatever you can think of that's simple. But they, of course, lack some sort of realism. And that's too bad. So some attempt has been made to tackle that, and we will see that in a second. And then, of course, additionally, there are also real phantoms. So real things that you put in the scanner, in the easiest case, you really have a water cylinder or just a bottle or whatever. But there are more complex ones, which we will see in a minute. Okay, so let's see numerical phantoms. Well, Shep-Logan phantom, probably all of you know that. You just go to MATLAB type phantom and you will get a Shep-Logan phantom. There is an extension to that because the Shep-Logan phantom is quite old. And since iterative reconstruction people used it extensively, people had to come up with some more complex things and more difficult things to reconstruct. And that's the Forbelt phantom. And some of you, I know some of you know that it's hard to reconstruct. Then we have this XCAT phantom, and that's exactly tackling the realism part for a numerical phantom. And there are many custom made. So if you go to a conference, you will see a lot of papers that say, okay, we have this nice new, rather theoretic approach here, and we just defined our phantom ourselves. So this seems complex. There is a circle with this and this, and they describe what they used, but they just define it themselves. So there are many custom ones out there. This is the Shep-Logan phantom. It's originally been designed for 2D, so this is what you probably know. And then there are some extensions to 3D as well. So here you see a projection of the 3D version, but I don't think that they have been published somewhere, the extensions, or also just as like a custom thing to use. Okay, this is the extension to the Shep-Logan phantom. This is the Forbelt phantom. And it's quite sad because this is already a reconstruction and you don't see all the low contrast objects that are actually in there. So here you would actually have eyes, but they are low contrast. Here you would have cerebral fluid, also low contrast. There are two spots here that are also low contrast. And you see that you don't see anything of that. It might be due to the windowing, to visualization window, but yeah. I actually had the chance to talk to one guy who was involved in designing this Forbelt phantom. And he said this should actually simulate the ear. Now don't worry, I don't know if it looks like that in your own anatomy, but so this is bone. And these are bubbles, so you can see the bubbles here. And they are actually air bubbles, and somehow they came up with the idea that there are some air bubbles in the ear, which is probably true because, yeah. But essentially, the guy just said to me, we had to come up with something very difficult. And that's the difficult part, and you can see that because the bubbles destroy a lot of things. They have streaking, they cause streaking here, they cause streaking here. And that's simply because of the high transitions that you have very often. So this is much more difficult than reconstructing a Shep-Logan phantom. Okay, you have XCAT. XCAT is tackling this realism problem. What they did, this visual human project, they did segmentations of the whole body. So basically each organ has been segmented, each type of bone, and they spent quite a lot of time on that. And what they then did with the segmentations, they used some points from the surface, and then they modeled the surfaces as splines. And what you can then do is you can deform them over time to get maybe a heart movement or just some sort of movement of body parts. The splines themselves are embedded in additional splines. So for example, you would have splines for the thigh bone, you would have splines for a bone down here, and the whole thing is then embedded in a spline called leg, right leg. So that's how it's done. And if you use that, and I have to say, this is purely numerical, and the projections don't really look like, they look very real. And I mean, this is cool, right? So you do projections, you have the beating heart here because the heart has been segmented, and also from prior research we know that the motion field can be incorporated into the splines. And I mean, this is great. So you see the rib cage, and you have moving phantoms that actually represent some more realistic things than, for example, a four-bit phantom. Okay, so there are different things. So we, you can, here we have the beating heart. This is, I think, just a 3D rendering, so this is not a projection. And in terms of legs, I think that's what we did ourselves. You can do even that. I mean, this wouldn't make any sense in a real system because you would never be able to reconstruct that because the motion is like in the 20 centimeter or even more range. Yeah, I mean, this is very nice and it looks pretty real. When I prepared for the lecture yesterday, I actually noticed that there is one mistake here. If you squat your leg, your kneecap will never go up here. Nobody noticed that so far, I have the feeling. So what typically happens, it goes down here and contacts to the thigh bone. So I think the kneecap just has been ignored in the motion. Okay, commonly used wheel phantoms. So the cat fan phantom is quite common. You have multiple layers of some homogeneous material, and you have embeddings in the material where you can place small parts with a certain given attenuation factor. Yeah, it mimics a water cylinder, but as I said, you can replace the embeddings with the attenuation that you're interested in. And then you do scans, and you can check for resolution, for example. System resolution can be checked with these. All kinds of things. Okay, there is this Randall-Alderson radiation therapy phantom. And so that's very interesting because that really tries to simulate a body shape as good as possible. And the cool thing is it's stacked up with slices. So you can just put out a slice and have a look at the slice directly, which is good because then you do a reconstruction. You see the reconstruction and you can see the actual phantom. So you can have a look at the slice and see if it's accurate. There are a couple of calibration phantoms. This is a very famous one. So you have like a plexiglass cylinder. This is actually in the inside, it's just air. So it's just a ring. And inside the plexiglass, you have metal beads. And what you do is you take projections of your system, and C-arm systems typically have some sort of wobble. So they have a slight shaking simply due to the gravity or so they're not as stable as static diagnostic systems. And what's typically done is you try some different trajectories, and then you take a calibration for the different trajectories, and you use projections. You use that calibration when you do another scan. So it won't be a straight circle. It will be some wobbling around the circle in 3D space. The nice thing is, again, this is exactly the same as with the legs. You can nicely detect these beads in the projections. And on top, they're even encoded. So you have bigger ones and smaller ones. So the bigger one so it's a binary code. The bigger ones can represent a 1 or a 0, and the smaller ones the opposite. So if you detect a couple of them, I don't know how many you would actually need out from the top of my head, but if you detect a range, you definitely know at which world point this is, because it's a unique pattern in the neighborhood. So you can always say, okay, I detect this range here of beads in my projection, and I can say, okay, this must have been from that and that place in world coordinates. And that's why this encoding is used. Here on the right, you actually see something from the knees. You have this typical vertical trajectory. And they did calibration. And when you do a calibration, you can read out the source to the detector distance. And that then varies a little bit because of the bending of the system or just shaking. And you can clearly see if you have a vertical trajectory, the system rotates and it's and gravity basically causes these bumps. So probably the source is heavier than the detector because it also has these collimation things going on with the lead plates and so on. So whenever the source is on top, it will bend the system downwards a little bit. And the other way around, so it will stretch it when it's at the bottom. And this is what you see here. And in this research paper, we showed that if you do a horizontal trajectory, we just had to validate that it's possible and that the C-arm motion is not killing our reconstructions. And we see that it's even more constant than in the usual vertical trajectories. So that was a good thing to see. Okay, so that's it for today. Well in time, good. Thanks very much.